encountered her yet, but she's there. Even maybe more. But it's also a place where within 26 Crozier Street, the essentials of our profession with Chrissy exist. The principles of the Fourth Estate have been taught over 40 years now. En dis juist goeie journalistiek wat nou in gedrang is, met wat bekend staan as die the disruptive digital economy. Afrikaans disruptiewe digitale ekonomie, en dis so 'n lelike ding, dit voel sommer so. But the media is een van die industrieë wat die meeste daaronder ly, want vir die tussenfase tussen 'n druk media model en 'n digitale media model het ons nog nie die antwoord nie. Daar kry ons vandag 'n paar antwoorde en hoop ons om in die toekoms daai antwoord te vind. Maar intussen bly dit 'n gegewe. Tussen 'n demokrasie en 'n disaster is daar maar net een waarborg, die vrye media. Without a free media, there can be no democracy. It's as simple as that. No individual freedom. It's the foundation for a democracy. Daarom ook dat ons gedenkpublikasie se titel nie net verwys na ons 40 jaar nie, maar ook die volgende fase in die ontwikkeling van ons professie, simbolies die 4.0 journalistiek wat vir ons voorlê. Nie net in terme van tegnologie nie wat ons omhels, maar uiteraard ook inhoud. And we specifically decided on the color blue for our cover, not only as background for that satellite, as image of a networked society, and as symbol for the Internet of Things that binds us all together, but also to show that we are optimistic about the future of the newsroom. In other words, journalism and everything that word implies in our 21st century world. Even though the mass media have been replaced by a media for the masses, we still need journalism, and we need it more than ever before. But then we as practicing journalists, especially, should also believe in our own profession and the values it stands for, that media freedom is the only guarantee for a democracy, and we ourselves should stop our own doom and gloom talks. And that's why we have decided on the color blue, because indeed, for journalism 4.0, the sky is the limit. And on that note, we would like to thank the Hemstra Trust for their financial support. En ons bedank ook graag African Sun Media vir hulle professionele diens met die uitgee van ons boek. Allow me to refer to two important quotes regarding the media and our role in the 21st century. The first is by Molly de Aguar, Director of the News Integrity Initiative of the City University of New York, who said, good journalism won't be enough, and that if journalists want the public to listen to them, then journalists have to listen to the public. And she added, if journalists want the public to care, then journalists have to care about the public. The second quote is by Catherine Viner, the editor-in-chief of The Guardian newspaper, who put it simply and succinctly, in turbulent times, we need good journalism more than ever. I think we all agree. So now let's continue with our panel. It's a cast of thousands in front of you. Let's hear what they have to say about the state of affairs regarding the Fourth Estate, en hoe tussen 'n demokrasie en 'n disaster net een ding staan, en dis die journalistiek. As you can see, we have an impressive panel, and the idea is that we have one round of specific questions, after which we will interact on some of the responses, and I hope we will also be able to engage with the audience, but obviously there's also some time outside as well. So laat ek my paneel voorstel in alfabetiese volgorde. George Klaassen, oud-departementshoof, baie van julle sal hom herken, onder andere voorpuntdenker op die gebied van wetenskapkommunikasie, lid van die internasionale ombudsorganisasie en tans onder andere ook ombud vir News 24. Langs hom, Tim Du Plessis, lid van die klas van 1978, so wat Piet Sleeu gesê het, sy oerklas, En ek het, ons het so 'n paar maatjies hier uit ons oerklas. Ek en Tim was inderdaad bankmaatjies ook geweest. Tim is oud-redakteur van Beeld en Rapport en nou hoof van aktualiteit by Kyknet. Dan het ons vir Marinette Jordaan, lid van die honeursklas van 2001, wat ook haar M in journalistiek gedoen het, tans docent in die departement, besig met haar PhD. Chantal Erfurt, an alumna of our department with an MA in journalism and editor-in-chief of all of independent newspapers, Cape Community Newspapers. Then Joanne Flores, Reikie van Reenen genoot van 2010, pas aangestel by die Sunday Times. En soos julle kan sien, ons het verteenwoordiging van alles in ons departement, ook ons Reikie genote wat Joanne verteenwoordig. Then we have Mpumi Mkabela, a member of the class of 1999, former editor of the Sowetan, chair of SANEF, now political commentator and part-time lecturer in politics at UNISA. And then last but certainly not least is Marie Weideman, member of the class of 1984, in other words the Gross era, former editor of Huisgenoot and editor-in-chief of all the Media 24 weekly magazines, now, as you know, CEO of Media 24. And Esmerie, ek hoop jy gaan my dit vergewe, maar tussen ons meisies, and I hope I don't embarrass her, the student who holds the record for the highest average pass mark ever in the department. Nice.
Ek
gaan nou nie sê hoeveel nie, but it's... So, nou is ons oor na die paneel en miskien is het Tim eerbaar en goed en reg om te begin met die verteenwoordiger van die oudste klas van die departement en ek begin met 'n vraag wat ons die hele middag kan besig hou. Maar opgesom, jou mening oor die stand van journalistiek in Suid-Afrika gegewe die geweldige uitdagings wat betref die oorlewing van die nuuskantoor.
Baie dankie, Lizet. Kan julle my hoor nou? Daar's hy. Baie dankie, Lizet. Baie dankie vir die uitnodiging. Terwyl ek hierso gekyk het na hierdie paneel hierso en oor die skare en almal, toe dink ek aan 'n storie wat Piet Selee in die klas vertel, die professor was the founding professor of the department. Told the story, he said there was this guy who walked out of a post office with a telephone directory in his hand and he looked very pleased with himself. And then someone said, are you happy about this book? And the guy said, well, I had a peek into the book. Not much of a plot, but what a cast. So, baie dankie hiervoor, Lizet. I want to start off by saying I think journalism in South Africa, the state of journalism, and it's a very generalized statement to make because, you know, I'm not talking about necessarily the business affairs of newspapers and other news media, but we're very solid. We proved our mettle through a very difficult period in South Africa's history. Ek het al dikwels gesê, wanneer hier die geskiedenis geskryf word oor die epoch wat ons vandag deurloop in Suid-Afrika, sal daar drie instellings wees wat eervolle vermelding verdien. Three institutions will receive honorable mention when they write the history of this period in our country. The first of all, the courts, I think they were magnificent. Some of the judges are really like rock stars of the democracy. And then the media, the free media, which all did a splendid job in making the public aware of what was going on and, you know, really started, kick-started the process to keep, to make politicians accountable. And then third of all, civil society. So ek dink die stand van journalistiek en die soort journalistiek wat ons in Suid-Afrika bedryf op die oomblik is in 'n baie goeie fase. Die geleentheid het om, we rose to the occasion. Ons was vir ons 'n geleentheid gewees om iets groots te doen en ons het dit gedoen. Ons is redelik bestand en redelik geïmmuniseer teen fake news, want ons mense in Suid-Afrika, dink ek en dis my algemene gevoel, soek geverifieerde, betroubare inligting met waarde. En dis wat data is. Ek het nou net hierdie Rubini boek gelees oor, weet nie hoe dit uitspreek nie, George, Homo Deus. Die ou het soort van 'n brief history of tomorrow, en hy sê die toekoms van die wêreld is data. Data gaan 'n ongelooflike belangrike ding doen. Wat is my eenvoudige verstaan van data? Betroubare, geverifieerde inligting met waarde. En dis wat ons in die afgelope tyd gedoen het. So ek dink dit gaan baie goed met ons. Alhoewel die sakemodelle van ontsettend baie besigheidsinstellings is besig om dood te gaan. Julle het almal die ding gelees wat sê media companies may not survive, but journalism will. Ons sal kyk of dit werklik waar so gaan uitspeel. Maar ek voel op in hierdie stadium waar ons is in ons land op die oomblik is kan ons trots wees op wat ons reg gekry het op die stand van journalistiek in ons land. Die belangrikste uitdaging vir ons nou is ons het regimeverandering gehad aan die politieke front. Almal voel 'n bietjie beter. Ons het 'n blaaskans gehad in terme van wat Jan Smuts gesê het, in Suid-Afrika gebeur die ergste nooit nie. In Desember het die ergste nie gebeur nie. Die belangrikste ding vir ons nou is om waaksaam te bly en seker te maak ons doen ons werk ordentlik en reg. En om jou aanhaling van die professor te gebruik, die Ierse professor wat gesê het, ons moet seker maak ons vryheid en ons waarde setel in mense se wil en begeerte om ons produkte te verbruik. So dankie.
Baie dankie Tim, baie insiggewend. Marinette, ek wil nou na jou toe gaan as lid van die volgende generasie van journalistiek en media opleiers en akademici. Wat dink jy, hoe kan ons in die onderrig en opleiding van journaliste antwoord op die uitdagings?
Ek dink eintlik aan daai antwoord maklik wees deur by Tim aan te sluit wat gesê het mense soek betroubare, geverifieerde inligting met waarde. En ek dink as jy 'n nuwe generasie journaliste oplei wat weet hoe om daai inligting te kry en dit aan te bied vir 'n gehoor op 'n manier wat dit vir daai gehoor sin maak, dan is jy op die regte pad. Want ek dink die ou debat van moet ons teorie of praktyk of waar moet jy daai balans vind, dit is iets van die verlede. Dit is regtig nie meer die moeite werd om daaroor te praat nie. Ek dink wat belangrik is, is om bewus te wees daarvan dat journalistiek programme moenie se uitsluitlike doel moenie wees om tegnologie vir die studente te leer nie. Natuurlik moet jy weet wat is VR journalistiek en jy moet weet wat is al die goed wat Andre vir julle leer wat ek hier die name van ken, analytics en data journalistiek en personalization of news, maar ek dink uiteindelik wat 'n mens vir die studente die boodskap wat hulle moet kry is dat hulle hierdie geverifieerde inligting moet kan vind en oordra en die enigste manier waarop jy dit kan doen is deur kritiese denke te kweek. Natuurlik help dit as die studente nuuskierig by jou aankom, wat nie altyd gebeur nie, maar to just quote as an academic, which I am as well, from a recent article from the Journalism and Mass Communication Educator, there was a study done that spoke to veteran digital journalists. Now, Lizette asked me if there's something like a veteran digital journalist. Now, some of these people have been working in some form of digital for 30 years. And they said about the new entrance into the field that we've lost the basics. They said that it doesn't help if students or new recruits come into the newsroom with a lot of technological prowess, but they can't write a story. They don't know what real news is. They have no accountability to the rest of the newsroom or to their public. So that's what we need to teach. We need to keep the students aware of the basic skills of journalism. En ek dink gelukkig doen ons dit by Krauserstraat. Ek dink almal wat daar gestudeer het en hopelik die klas van 2018 wat hier sit en hopelik konsentreer. As ek van die van julle wat nog nie gekyk het nie, for those of you who haven't seen Mati Media, which is their website that they run, I really think it's a good showcase for their talent and for all the different skills that they learn from the Reikies, who Andre Gous represents this year. Maar ek dink om aan te sluit by wat Lizette ook gesê het, ons moenie te pessimisties wees oor die toekoms as jy studente oplei nie. En ons kry die ongelukkig die geval dat baie mense wat met ons studente kom praat, vertel vir hulle hoe moeilik is dit om in journalistiek te wees. Ek dink mense moet hulle eerder uitdaag oor die geleenthede wat daar is en wat hulle self hulle kan skep deur kursusse soos Prof Raba se Baba, die Media Entrepreneurs the Media Entrepreneurship course, which I really think will teach the students how to develop their own products and to think beyond the newsroom and to think like business people. We were taught that to an extent that the media and the MBA shouldn't rule the newsroom, but I think to a large extent journalists need to know that now. En ek dink uiteindelik gaan dit daaroor om terug te kom na die punt van kritiese denke, eerlike verslaggewing en plain common sense. Dit dink ek is vir my ek wil eindig.
Ja. Dankie Marinette. I'm carrying on with the first round of questions, each of your field of specialization. So I'm on to Chantal now. Chantal, you're such a passionate community journalist. You believe in the role of community media. As an expert in the field, what do you think did our media fail to do in reporting the water crisis in the Western Cape? Should journalists have been more alert, and should they have cornered politicians right from day one instead of now harking on day zero?
Okay, in the spirit of not being too pessimistic, I am going to present both sides of the argument, because I feel that we did do some things quite poorly, but I think there are also some things that we did quite well. And knowing the tremendous pressure that newsrooms are under, I often feel reluctant to be too harsh in our criticism. And I'm also acutely aware of the fact that as an editor, I'm also criticizing myself when I criticize newsrooms. Nonetheless, my feeling is this. Newsrooms are imperfect operations that should always strive for perfection. And when we don't reach that perfection, we should just keep trying harder. So it's in the spirit of this sentiment that I'm going to reflect on how we covered the water crisis. First and foremost, I think our greatest failure in this regard was that, particularly when we started writing about the water crisis or the water management crisis, we allowed the city to control the narrative. So it was the politicians who were telling us what to report on. Most media were caught napping, and when not covering the issue was no longer an option, we simply allowed the city of Cape Town to dictate what we should tell our readers. Everything we wrote about largely depended on what the city sent to us in media releases. And we were just as panicked as we made readers. On the flip side, however, I think as we settled into the idea that the water shortage and the water restrictions were becoming our new normal, to coin a city phrase, many media did start shifting the reporting focus to the experiences of people on the ground. And I believe this was a very important shift, because it encouraged us as the media to explore the questions that everyday people had and were asking. And it also forced us to be more proactive in creating useful content rather than simply delivering doom and gloom to our readers. What we also need to put under the spotlight is that the drought is an environmental issue. And with the environmental beat having all but disappeared from our newsrooms and reporting structures, we took our eye off the ball and effectively silenced environmental experts who would have been able to comment on this long before the city went into crisis mode over the water shortage. Mm. So this is a very practical illustration of the importance of specialization in an era where we're so focused on cultivating generalists, all-rounders, and multitaskers. And so now what we should be thinking about is what next. Our challenge, and in the newsroom, we're always thinking, what next? And the city's pretty much gone, you know, a little bit quiet in terms of day zero and in terms of its media releases that it was sending out quite fervently. So our challenge is to keep the water discussions alive and to be very practical and level-headed about it, even as the city sort of tones down its excitement about it, if that's the word. We must also remain cognizant that a whole new economy has emerged around the water shortage, and we must not allow ourselves to be taken advantage of by these manufacturers of the next best water-saving gadget, because they are out there, and they're seeking the attention of journalists who are looking for new angles to report on the water crisis, and sometimes not perhaps savvy enough to recognize when they're just being used to deliver nothing more than an advertising message to readers. So in a nutshell, I think there were things that we did well, and there were things that we realized we were not doing well, and we did improve on that.
Right, thank you. And I think what you mentioned in terms of the environmental issue is also something that we need to attend to from the media side. But we can carry on with that topic now. Ek is nou op Joanne. Tim het ook verwys na mediavryheid, ek het verwys na mediavryheid, uitdrukking van spraak. My vraag aan jou is die kommentaar op nuuswebwerwe regtig geleenthede vir mense om hulle reg tot vryheid van uitdrukking te gebruik? Of is dit echokamers vir onverdraagsaamheid, waarin racisme, selfs haatspraak, onbehoorlik lig kry? Jy was self die slagoffer van sulke kommentare verlede jaar, en nou pas weer met jou Afrikaans stuk wat jy geskryf het. Laat ons bykie hoor, wat denk jy?
Ja, ek denk van die begin af wil ek mens sê, ek wens mens wil by die opskrif lees, en as hulle die inhoud lees, hulle gesien weet, en ingelichte menings maak. Maar die een deel les wat ons geleer het door die kommentare, dit is een pijnlijke proces elke dag. Maar om dit af te maak, as net een mense wat klakkeloos praat, dan kan een bietjie onverantwoordelik wees. Die punt is, ergens het, voel iemand hulle het iets om te sê. En miskien is dit om daar nie ander maniere is om hulle stem te laat hoor, ek weet nie eintlik nie. Maar my probleem of my ondervinding is dat mense te makkelijk met die stroom gaan, ongelukkig. So, daar is hier een diepte van begrip vir wat jy lees, of een behoefte om self te onderzoek wat jy lees, wat denk ek daar oor hee. Mense word verskrikkelijk vinnig meegevoer. So, ek gaan net gauw vinnig terug gaan na my onlangse rubriek oor taal. En die opskrif het gesê, dis hoekom ek nie vir Afrikaans beklein nie. Afrikaans is my huistaal, is my geboorte taal, is my alles. So wat ek gesê het was, ek gaan nie vir Afrikaans beklein nie, want ek hoef nooit te bekleid vir Afrikaans. Dit was altyd deel van my DNA, van my alles. So ek het in die totale huis groot geword, want niemand gesê het, nou praat ons Afrikaans, of Afrikaans krijg 20%, en Engels krijg 50%, of wat ook al he. Dit was een baie natuurlijke twee goed wat saamgeleef het in een ruimte. En ek was, toe ek December bereis, met vakantie was, het het my weer opgeval hoe verskrikkelijk levendig Afrikaans is daar op my thuisdorp in Wellington. Jy hoor heeltyd nuwe uitdrukkings, jy hoor heeltyd nuwe gesegdes, jy hoor hoe mense name en goed opmaak om iets te beskryf. En dis toe wat my laat dink om die rubriek te skryf, want ek wil vir mense sê, staan bykie terug, ek weet daar is hoor funksies van Afrikaans, ek weet daar is alle klomp goed, maar doen ons die tale verskrikkelike ongunst aan, om so hard te beklei, dat ons mense wat andersins die taal sou omarm, en baie lief is vir die taal, om hulle half harig te maak, en te laat terugstaan nie. So, die kommentare, toevallig op die ding was, oor die opskrif, en niemand het gegaan na die inhoud van die story nie. So, met my inhoud wil ek sê, net om die kommentare nie gunstig is of lekker is, he. Wil ek hier die recht moet van mense weggehou word. He. Want, weet, op die volgende ding, stem ons dalk oor iets saam. Maar hoe gaan ons weet, as ons mekaar die geleentheid gee, om toch maar te sê ons voel daaroor, he. Recht of verkeerd, ons kan nie saam sê oor alles, he. So, ek wens, daar was een goeie staf, wat vir mense sê, dink net en voor jy neerskryf, is dit iets wat jy rarig in jou hart en siel self oortuig is van. Mm. En hier is stroom wat vir jou net saamvat. He. En ek dink, ons staan, en ons amal skuldig aan, ons staan baie weinig terug, want dit is een bietjie knee-jerk reaction die is daar. Jy weet, jy hoor iets, sorg om te dink, slaat jy terug. Mm. En ek dink, vir ons amal, of ek probeer het een les maak, staan een bietjie terug, al is jy hoe betrokken, staan terug, en kyk, is daar nie toch een merite nie, want dit is ook een deel wat aansluit by ons opleiding as journaliste en hoe ons ons self heel tyd moet, want ons moet ook ons eie sterkste kritiese en wagon wees. Ons moet ons eie wagon wees. En net om iets nie lekker val op die hart en op die oor, beteken dit nie, dit is een bietjie een goeie manier om introspeksie te doen nie. So, jy moet maar die soet met die sier vat. Jy moet vat die mense wat vir jou sê, well done, en jy moet ook die klappe vat van die wat sê, het jy idee waarvan jy praat. He. En dan moet jy miskien terugstaan en kyk, het ek genoeg geweet waarvan ek praat, voor ek die mening gelig het. Rian van Heerden het een lieflike rubriek die week geskryf, waar hy sê, want hy is baie omstrede, hy is permanent in die moeilikheid op die radio. En hy sê, hy het nou deesdae wakkerder wag voor sy mond. Maar hy sê ook, oor die kommentare sê, hy sê gevoel is, ons moet meer praat met die stille meerderheid. Want wat ons sien is die fringe, ons sien die grens, die uiterstes. Of die uiterste goeie is, of die uiterste kwaad mense. En waar is die silent majority? Spandeer ons het te veel tyd om te worry oor die wat galbraak hier, en ons vergeet met wie ons eindelijk moet praat. Ons het een grote werk om te doen naar buiten. Maar ons gaan net eens een beetje terugstaan en besef waar lê ons verantwoordelijkheid. Ja,
ek is baie beïndruk met jou leef en laat leef ingesteldheid, vooral na die goeders wat mense gesê het op die kommentaar webwerf van waar jy gewerk het. En dat die mens dit wel vir hulle as 'n geleentheid moet gee om hulle mening te lig, maar dan, soos jy sê, dan raak hulle meegesleer en dis dieselfde. En dan as die compulsieve sub, wat ons allemaal geleer het by Pietselier, wat die compulsieve sub was, jy wil toch net hê, asseblief spel net reg.
Ja.
Jy kan sê wat jy wil, maar spel net reg.
Ja.
Goed, Joanne, van jou ervaring oor nou daai soort van onverdraagsaamheid en toch een menig fout van kommentare, na George. George, ons kom uit 'n verdeelde samelewing en uit daai kommentare blyk dit hoe min verdraagsaamheid daar regtig tussen mens en mens is. En nou oor die etiek en jou ervaring as ombuds man, ombuds persoon, ombud, wat doen sulke soort kommentaar aan ons samelewingse skering en inslag? Met ander woorde, moet digitale nuuswebwerwe nie meer hekwagter speel oor die soort kommentaar waarvoor al platforms gebruik word nie, of dalk misbruik word nie? En my vraag is, dra dit regtig by tot nasionale debat en die diskoers wat ons so nodig het, die suurstof wat ons nodig het op al hierdie kwessies rondom ons?
Ja, dit is eintlik 'n twee snydende swaard. En Lizette, in the first place, we have to be more tolerant. Ek dink Antjie Krog het baie goed gestel. In haar een boek van haar was sy ook groot in die moeilikheid was. We have to be more tolerant, but how do you advance democracy if you don't allow so many voices? En dit is die dilemma waar ons sit. Dit is die dilemma waar News 24 sit het, toe hulle kommentare toegemaak het, in die meeste plekke. Hoewel dit nog daar is, jy kan maar gaan kyk, dit wat hulle oopmaak, ek is nou 'n maand en ek is 6 weke News 24 se public editor, wat eintlik 'n ombudsman is. And you can't imagine the type of spewing of aggravating aggressiveness by people. Ek dink Joanne het baie goed opgesom. Ek het dit self gesien in my resensie van Tim Nouk se boek Law of Nutrition hierdie week, die kommentare wat daar was. Ek kan die mense antwoord of kan ek stil bly. Maar die punt is, as journalists we are accountable. And we have to set a certain standard of accountability and to accept the notion that if we don't apply the same rules we want from ex-president Zuma, are we accountable? Do we accept that we can make mistakes? I think Mr. Vosloo was the person who accepted and first advanced the question of internal ombuds people at Media 24 at NASPERS and supported the idea. And to come link up with what Chantal said about the water crisis, I think personally journalists dropped the ball with this whole crisis because we don't have proper science journalists. People knowing what the environmental, Jorisna Bontuis predicted 15 years ago as the leading South African environmental journalist at die Burger. She won the award twice for the best South African environmental journal. And the all the international panel of climate change predictions were that the Western Cape will become dry within the next 2 decades. The journalists didn't pick it up. They didn't ask the right questions. Now we are suddenly aware. And that is part of our ethical obligation, to be accountable and say, listen, we made a mistake. And I think if we want to have a fair democracy in South Africa, we have to be at the best form of journalism. Tim referred to it, and I totally agree with him. If the journalists weren't there, and civil society, and the courts, we wouldn't have succeeded in this whole opening up the can of worms. And it was a journalist from the Department of Journalism at Stellenbosch University, an ex-journalist, Mandy Rousseau, who discovered Nkandla. She was the first one to see it.
I thought it was Zuma.
I don't think he ever came there. Maybe he swam in his that
fire
pool.
The
fire pool. But to sum it up, Lizette, I think every journalist should ask him or herself the question, are we accurate? The four pillars of journalism, of good ethical journalism. Are we accurate? Do we make mistakes? The second one, do we minimize harm? And that comes to the question of these commentators putting all their aggravation there. Do we minimize harm? The third one is, are we independent? Are we allowed to be independent? And we know, and Mr. Vosloo and his generation of journalists will tell us, that was the, and Tim, when you were a political reporter at Beeld in the early 80s, the South African government, the apartheid government, wanting to force us to be regulated. Not to self-regulation, but to be registered as on a register of journalists, etc. And then the fourth one, are we accountable? And that's why media ethics becomes so important. And we have an international organization of news ombuds and standards editors. We have an annual congress where all the BBC and National Public Radio in America and all these people are. And you see they have the same problems as we, where you have itchy fingers from governments, from local government to the top, wanting to interfere with the job we have to do. And that is the biggest problem we have. And we have to be aware of it all the time.
Yeah, yeah. The watchdogs, in other words. Mpumi, we're on to you. You have wide experience both as editor and as media leader, chair of SANEF. With regard to media freedom that has been mentioned now a couple of times, what should journalists do as a collective to ensure that there is no meddling with the independence of newsrooms, those itchy fingers that we heard just now, both from politicians, but also from corporates?
Thanks, Prof. It's a very difficult one, but at the risk of overlapping with some of the comments that have been made, perhaps the starting point to answer the question is to list where exactly are the sources that threaten good journalism.
Yeah.
I think there are six sources that are a threat to good journalism. One is journalists themselves. Two are the media owners. I'm sorry, Esmer is here. And Don Fosler is here. That's the media owners. Three are the media users, the consumers. Four are the advertisers. Five is the government. And six are the people that we now hail as the people who invented the digital space. But at the same time, they are not tolerant enough to allow certain views. They don't want to be criticized. The so-called Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, your Bezos, Zuckerberg, and the like. So once we have identified the sources, the question is, how do each one of them affect good journalism or the freedom for journalists to work as they should? Journalists impact negatively on their craft by being unethical. If you are being unethical, you allow other people who don't like the media at all to pretend as if actually they like the media, except that they don't like you, the unethical journalist. And then through that, they have a window to come in and tell you what you should do and what you should not do. And in that way, we lose our independence through our own making as journalists. So that, for me, is a starting point. We can debate about how do you get an ethical journalist into the newsroom, and how do you know that this person will be unethical once they are employed in the newsroom. You can actually get a very ethical, upright journalist who can transform to be very unethical in the newsroom. We have had cases like that. So how do you deal with that? It's a bit of a messy challenge, so to put it. Government is a threat to good journalism because, for some reason, governments, even in a democratic society like ours, somehow the government thinks that it can represent the interest of the public all the time. And it's not always the case. Governments, often we have seen it throughout the world, and we have seen it here in South Africa, under the previous order, even in the current order, where the government's interests are actually inimical to the interests of the public. But for some reason, they think that they are representing the interests of the public. We have seen it through the secrecy bill. They've pushed it very hard. The ANC parliamentarians have been instructed now, and they've accepted the instruction that they must initiate a media appeals tribunal, because they think that they represent the public interest insofar as the media is concerned. And that's not always the case. If I may make an example with the SABC, and then perhaps we can start mentioning a few solutions to the problem. The SABC is said to be a public broadcaster in terms of the law and regulations and everything. But practically, it's impossible to make the SABC a public broadcaster while it relies on funding from the government. When we are said to be downgraded by rating agencies, and that, well, it happens because partly the SABC debt is taken into account, and because the government is underwriting that debt. And if the government underwrites the debt, the government thinks that in its own wisdom, it can actually use the SABC whichever way it likes, because it can discipline the people who run the SABC by refusing to issue guarantees, by refusing to give the SABC money. But someone might say, well, let the SABC be driven by profit, so it doesn't have to rely on government for funding. But there comes another problem which the rest of the media has, which the threats come from advertisers. Advertisers who don't appreciate the role of the media interfere. They try very hard to think that they think they can run the newsroom. They think they know best what journalists or how journalists should report news. So they've come up with all kinds of schemes, from native advertising to buying journalists dinners and lunches and all kinds of things, to basically buy them and actually reorientate them so that they are not longer loyal to the craft. They are loyal to the advertisers. Editors are under pressure. So if some big company calls the editor and say, well, I'm looking for journalists who can go to this trip, and you know that as recently as now, this particular company has bought the whole web space or the whole front page, and they've given the paper so much money, it's difficult for the editor to say no, because you are thinking, I need revenue. I need to account to the media owners. The media owners want... These days, and we must talk about these things openly, the media owners these days make editors sign contracts that go beyond journalism. You are supposed to make your platform to be so-called commercially viable. But sometimes being commercially viable can be inimical to good journalists, to good journalism. How do you balance commercial viability, which is survival of the newspaper or survival of the website, which is very good because you need the paper to survive? How do you balance that with the interest of the, with commercial viability that actually is in contradiction with good journalism? It's a very difficult question. The other source of the threat, which we, I think ombuds people deal with it, is the threat that comes from media consumers themselves, who are very intolerant, I think George referred to, are very intolerant. You see, you sit in a situation where you think your views are the most important views than all other views. And as a result, unwittingly, you actually suppress other people's views under the name of your right to freedom to speak out. And then in that same vein, other people must not speak out. So that's a threat. We need to continuously educate readers. And they can be a threat not to journalism as a craft. They can be a threat to journalists, actually, as human beings. We see that every day when a journalist writes something, the next thing is confronted by some criminal who say, but why did you write that story? You're not a good journalist. Simply because the story implicates that person in some criminality. So we need to educate people along those lines. So I don't want to belabor the points, but I'm saying these are the things that newsrooms and the academia should continuously debate. There are no easy answers. We celebrate today. Last year we celebrated 500 years of 5 centuries since the establishment of the printing press. And we know that the printing press, when it was established back in the day in Germany, it was used by the Protestants to actually mount a campaign against the Catholics. And so from that day on, the media was always going to be susceptible to political manipulation, political abuses. And today we celebrate about over 2 decades now when the internet had gone global. Yet the guys that are behind this digital revolution, the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, they, under the guise of liberalism, are now also threatening the integrity of these platforms by refusing to be criticized. So they don't want self-regulation, but they also don't want other people to regulate them, to check on the ethics. As a result, we're having fake news now being used to discredit otherwise good journalism. I'm not saying fake news doesn't exist, but these days the concept of fake news is also being used to discredit good journalism. So people can easily dismiss it and say fake news in just 2 lines, fake news, and then suddenly the whole story must collapse, when in fact we know it's true. So how do you protect journalism in this era of globalization of news? Mm. It's one of those, it's a very difficult question. Mm. So I'm sorry, Prof, I might not have provided the answers, but I think perhaps with regard to the entrepreneurs, we need angel investors, people that are not interested in immediate profit gain, people who already have made the monies elsewhere, but they are now interested in the good of society. Let good journalism flourish. We know, for example, Amabungane, who we are very proud about, are not being funded by people who are looking for profit gain. Part of their funding comes from Open Society Foundation. We know that, I know he's a very controversial figure. You know who I'm talking about. He's a very controversial figure, but he's made his money through speculation and other things. He's no longer interested in making money now. That's George Soros. So he's investing in a lot of goodwill stuff. And without that kind of investment, I'm not sure that Amabungane would have helped us to unearth the whole Nkandla and state capture thing and all of this stuff. So we need angel entrepreneurs who are not interested in immediate gain, so that they're not under pressure from anybody. The only thing that they are under pressure is to get societies to work ethically. And then we also, of course, need ethical journalism. I highlighted how difficult that is. We need a public broadcaster that can work. But I think for the SABC to be a real public broadcaster, we need ordinary citizens to be the ones who fund it. Not via the government. We need to find some other mechanism through which we can fund a public broadcaster. Because if you fund it through the government, it means using our taxes. And we know the government doesn't think our taxes is our taxes. The government thinks that our taxes is their money, the politicians. We know that. So we can't change that. So we need to find a mechanism to fund a public broadcaster directly from citizens. Open it up. There's no way you can have a public broadcaster that's mediated by, where the citizens' interests are mediated in between by the government. It's not going to happen. Maybe I should stop there.
Okay. Thank you, Mpumi. I think you've illustrated how complex the situation is. And Esmarie, certainly last but not least, jy het nou geluister, dit klink, jy voel seker soos iemand wat nou so op 'n balanseerbalkie moet jouself moet, aan die een kant is dit die besigheid van media, aan die ander kant is dit die journalistiek, journalism that needs to prevail. You're a passionate journalist, the only kind that should ever become media managers, same as Prof. Ton Foslu here. How do you foresee the sustainability of journalism and the newsroom in a digital age? Everything you've heard here. And do you think that digital journalism can also be a journalism of record? And not follow the trend of superficiality of social media, and instead of being the first draft of history, contributes to dumbing down society. The CEO of Naspers said he gives newspapers 5 more years, and he already said that some time ago. Now, your response. And I know this is no a mondful.
It's a great mondful, Lizette. Bye, donkey. It really is absolutely fantastic to be here. I remember my year in Crozier Street with great fondness. And it's good to see so many faces that I know in the audience. Before I start, I'm not going to talk as long as my friend Mulevia. I just want to say I'm very sorry that you never were an editor at at Media 24, because our editors actually do not have to listen to advertisers. Okay, Lizette, let's start with the issue of how long do newspapers have. We plan for anything between 3 and 5 years, right? I can show you lists, and I think some of us will sometimes laugh when we have a look at those lists, about publications that we thought would never survive and publications we thought would actually survive forever, and then the picture changes, right? So I'm not particularly concerned about exactly when print will disappear. I think in terms of newspapers, local community news titles have very, very long legs. It's a very important part of journalism and media in this country. Some time ago, we were very concerned about our Sunday newspapers. They play such an incredibly important role in terms of the democracy in this country. And all of a sudden, it's going much better with our Sunday newspapers. And then we worry about our dailies, and then that goes better again. So there are too many factors to actually say whether it's going to be 5 months or 5 years. I do not know. I can tell you with absolute certainty, newspapers will not be there in 5 decades, without a doubt. I had a chat with some young students the other day, between the ages of 20 and 25, not one of them has ever read a newspaper. They laughed at me when I asked the question. So we need to prepare ourselves for that. And as much as, we plan for these things, and we actually take a pretty negative view, and then every time the newspaper guys completely surprise us, and then we celebrate it, right? For me, the important thing is really not whether journalism will survive on paper. We all love our newspapers, absolutely, but as the managers of a large media company in South Africa, what we need to be concerned about is whether journalism will survive. Mm. It's not about the paper, it is about the craft. And personally, I am actually really, really, really excited about what's happening with media at the moment. I'm absolutely loving the fact that, so for the longest time, we said, serious journalism, so we know the cat memes and all of that, how is serious journalism going to survive the internet? That, to me personally, was a huge, huge worry a few years ago. Look what is happening now. I mean, most of the Gupta leaks happened on digital platforms. And I think that is a huge positive sign in media. And I think there's more to come. One can talk, and I'm sure we can talk later on about the business model around that, because, that is a real challenge. Tim spoke about that right at the outset. But personally, I am very excited about the future of journalism, and I am very excited about some of the digital models that we see coming up around the world. I think news journalism is sexier than ever, and certainly more important than ever.
Thank you, Esmeri. That's such an upbeat message to all of us, so thank you for that. And I agree with you. Digital sounds like such an easy solution. It is so wonderful just to press the button and you have all the news there, instead of having, going to the printers and then onto trucks and then to Kukanap And the whole, you know, footprint of the uitlaatgassen and all of that, whereas with digital, it's there. But on a technical note, it's still slow, etc. Don't you think our biggest challenge is access to broadband? Isn't that the real issue we're talking about?
Yeah.
On a technical note.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm fond of telling the story when I first met Bob van Dijk, just before he became the CEO of Naspers. I sat there and I was, you know, tearing my hair out about broadband, and we've got all these lovely products in the market and these apps and these websites and this and that, the other thing. And he looked at me and he said to me, what a lovely problem to have. In the sense that at least you will be prepared for when it happens. So in terms of broadband, that holds back media. It's the speed of broadband, it's the price of broadband, it's the availability of broadband. I think this society will look very different, and I think news media will look very different when those audiences really, really come onto the platforms when there's accessible broadband. Having said that, I do want to, you know, I have to punt my people here quickly, right? So, the biggest problem, and I think this is really the issue that should be debated and be debated really frequently. You touched on, you know, sort of advertisers and the fact that they also have a responsibility. News media in South Africa, in terms of digital news media, don't have a readership problem. Yes, the audiences will be a lot bigger when broadband is freely available and cheaper. News media in South Africa and around the world have an advertising problem. And I think it is time for us as journalists and media owners, I so hate that word, as journalists, to start educating advertisers as well about the role of media in our societies, and the fact that I believe they actually have a joint responsibility to make sure that media survives. News24.com, Media24's, all Media24's digital publications, whether it's Netwerk 24 or HuffPost South Africa or News24 or Fin24 or all these products that you guys know. As a whole, 24.com has, in most months, more users in South Africa than Facebook. And between Google and Facebook, they take 83% of the advertising revenue in this market, and the stats are more or less the same around the world. Just in the last year, the latest available statistics, of all the new digital advertising money that came into this market, and this is a known statistic, Google took 96% of that money. So the problem really is, what are news organizations going to do to become sustainable in terms of digital media? We are investing hugely in our digital media, because we know we're preparing for a world when print will die. Whether it's 5 years or 50 really isn't the issue. But it is our responsibility to make sure that our newsrooms are staffed properly and that digital media survives, because that is what we will have in 50 years' time.
And then the main challenge is the revenue stream to also sustain those journalists who need to uphold democracy. Which we know is one of your challenges. Can I ask anyone in the panel who would like to interact with what has been said? Enige kommentaar op die kommentare? Wie wil eers te gaan uit die paneel?
I actually want to ask a question, since I have all these illuminated, what do you call them?
Very
luminaries. Thank you.
Illuminaries.
We are illuminated with these lights here.
We have the students of this year, the class of 2018 is sitting here. What do you think we should teach them this year?
I think everything that has been said, you know, how to not, your bullshit detector, people, must be so strong that nobody, not even the city of Cape Town, can actually get past you, right? So a journalist needs a good bullshit detector. To have that, you need to be really critical and you need to read, right? I come across far too many young people who actually just have a Facebook feed about, you know, whatever it is that interests them. I think it is really important that journalists understand the role of developers and engineers in the newsrooms. I don't know, I should know, whether you guys teach them any kind of coding. I still worked on a typewriter when I was in Crozier Street, so that shows you how things change. I think, you know, it's really important that multidisciplined teams come together to create really, really good journalism. And we had a beautiful example recently with the anniversary of of Chris Barnard's heart transplant, and we're still quite slow with this as well. But for one of the first times, we actually had a team of engineers, editors. And there were some people who were looking at this from an advertising perspective. They managed to get the whole thing sold. It was a project with editorial integrity, but it got sold. But the exciting thing was to see the interaction between the engineering team and the journalistic team to really create something that was beautiful and won one of our 21 prizes at the Bookmark Awards last night. So I think it's important that journalists understand that, and for the rest, just those basics that you were talking about. And then, of course, we know that, you know, in the days where I suppose Tim and I were became journalists, I mean, if you were really good behind your computer, you could, you know, be a really good journalist. And you had to ask the right questions. Nowadays, these guys, I feel sorry for them to some extent, but I'm also very excited about the possibilities of it. They have to do absolutely everything, right? You need to be able to tweet. You need to be so accurate because you can't get it wrong. So you need to be able to tweet. You need to be able to blog. You need to be able to take video. You need to even actually be able to edit your own video. And then you've got to be able to find angles for stories that will survive tomorrow in a print product that is long covered on a digital platform. So it is hugely challenging. But I have to say, the young journalists that we get into Media 24, many of them, Lizette, from here, I check in with our editors all the time about whether they're happy with the quality of people they get, and they are superstars. So I hope you guys will be part of the new intake of young superstars at Media 24 at the end of the year.
Annette, if I can say something, I think it's very important that young journalists understand, and older ones as well, that you don't publish in a vacuum. Producing journalism is not like feeding birds, where you put the seed out there and hope for the best. You must connect with the community, create the community, find the community, connect, and publish into a community, and make sure they understand what you're doing. I also happen to do, and that's another important thing, I also happen to do a bit of work behind the scenes at Carte Blanche, the Mnet program on Sunday evenings, whom the most older people who are regular watchers of television will know about. And oftentimes I see stories there that, before it goes out on the previews, the stories like the SAPA night lead. Now, the older journalists will remember SAPA was a news agency, a very good sort of news agency of record, with a big court case like the Oscar Pistorius trial, for instance. They would, in the course of the day, file 4 or 5 stories about, you know, everything that happened in the court on that particular day. And then at about 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock at night, when most of the morning newspapers go to press, they would produce what is called the SAPA night lead. And there was this wonderful story, usually about 600 or 700 words, and it summed up everything that happened that day in court. These were the important events. This was what the judge said. This is what the accused looked like when the judge said this. All summed up in one little story, the night lead. At Carte Blanche, oftentimes, when there's a big story in the week, they would, on a Sunday evening, produce a story similar to a SAPA night lead. And we must think about that. Alistair Sparks, the former editor of the Rand Daily Mail, once said, the problem with the daily newspapers, that was about 10, 15 years ago, he said, the problem with the daily newspapers is they do snapshot reporting. They do a little bit, they take a snapshot of this and a snapshot of that, and then they think that's journalism. And what readers and viewers and listeners actually want is an integrated picture. They want to understand what is going on. So that's a skill, if I can offer some advice to young journalists. Develop a skill to understand the story. And that thing about snapshot journalism in the era of social media has become actually worse, because Twitter is nothing but micro snapshot reporting. You still don't get a full picture. What is it, 280 characters these days? How can you tell a big, complicated story in 280 characters? There's a need for, sorry? You do what? Mr. Trump, well, yeah, look where that's getting him. You know, 32% approval rating. It's very important, you know, people want in the complicated lives that people live in the era of fake news, Twitter, the proliferation of me, people really want to understand what's going on. Because what's the essential job of a journalist? It's to provide a point of orientation for people as they navigate their lives through a very complicated environment and help them to understand, and you will find a niche. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other comments from the panel? Bumi?
I'll be very quick this time around.
No problem.
I think that one of the things that we need to teach journalism students now is the history of our country. I think a lot of people might be asking themselves, why should we bother about all of these things? You guys are talking about, you know, democracy, media, and all of that. What's the fuss all about? We should not assume that everybody knows about it, that our students know about it. Teaching just a brief history of our country, where we come from, unashamedly, unbiased, just teach it as it is, and say, why did we come to where we are now, and why it's important for you as a journalist to play your role to sustain or even grow our democracy, to be vibrant, to be diversity, to have all kinds of things, to sustain it. Otherwise, you can actually have people who can easily, you know, negate our democracy from the newsrooms, not because they want to, just because they don't know.
Good point. George.
What Mpumi is saying there is very true, because who of the journalists, young journalists sitting here today, will know who Zwelakhe Sisulu is, who was locked up for 2 years without trial, amongst the prayer pursued by the security police, many journalists, newspapers closed down, many journalists were threatened with their lives. I think Futa Kriha sits here in front from the SABC, one of the SABC 8 heroes. Somebody died, Suna Fenter died because of what happened last year. And we should never forget that, the historical perspective we should have as journalists of our society and where do we come from. We can't live in a vacuum and being ignorant.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm...
Yeah. No,
on my old hobby,
that's very important. Yeah. Cultural literacy, it's called, and you have been introduced to that, but we need a layered understanding of our past, where we come from and where we are heading. And I actually wanted to ask Futa, as one of the SABC 8 sitting here, just maybe also a comment from you, and then we'll open the floor for questions from the audience. Can we, Futa, gaan jy jou stem laat
dra?
Laat dra.
As ek geweet ek moes praat, so ek voorbereid. Just one thing about the SABC quickly. We are not government funded. I think 5% of our revenue comes from the government. The problem really was the capture of journalism in the SABC. And just on that note, it's still not over. And if we think that Cyril Ramaphosa and good news we broadcast a couple of days, if you look at the SABC, I believe it's a microcosm of what happens in politics. And we removed Slari, we removed Jimmy Matthews, one or two people. The other people are still there. And they make the decisions. The company secretary that was supposed to be criminal investigated, the ad hoc committee's final recommendations. She's GE of governance at the moment. They're still there. The decisions are still being made by the same people, and that's what's going to happen in the politics also if we as journalists do not follow up and if we do not keep vigilant on what's happening. Just on one thing about... The SABC as a public broadcaster, we as the SABC 8 with some people were looking at the possibility of appointing a board based on the German model, which is a democratic process where each and every interest group in the country can appoint somebody and fund them. They do not get paid, but they represent the people. So the gay community or the churches, or they can appoint someone on the board in order to make it a true representative public broadcaster. The thing about funding, there's a lot of countries that use a levy, a tax levy that they that's deducted from everyone that we get with the accident fund and so on. So where each and everyone fund the public broadcast, and I think only then we will be able to be really a public broadcaster. But I think the biggest problem is the politics, and we are seeing. I've been through Snooki Zikilala, I've been through Zululaki Sisulu, I've been through the whole thing, and every time there's a shift in politics, there's a shift in the internal workings of the SABC, and it's busy at the moment, and it's still going on.
Thank you, Futa. Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to pose a question to the panel?
Kamba, would you come fix it? I'm too scared to jump off here.
Can I just tell
you? Kamba? Yeah.
Too much pressure. Yeah. I want to address something that you said. We must speak openly about things as journalists and us as journalists in training. And my one thing is the ethical journalism that we speak about can't be hidden away from certain, I don't want to say agendas, but I want to say certain codes that certain media houses abide by. So you'll have your ANN 7s and your TNAs that have a certain agenda that they push. Where then does ethical journalism stand when you have media houses that have certain agendas or have certain codes of conduct that they abide by for their journalists?
Kamba, is there anyone specific you'd like to answer on that?
Well, I don't know, whoever feels like
to
it.
To respond, who would like to respond? George?
I can answer that. Media houses don't adhere to a specific code that is their own code. The codes are for broadcasting, the Broadcasting Complaints Commission's code of conduct. You've got a complaint against SABC or Prime Media or whatever, you go to the Broadcasting Complaints Commission. They've got a very good ethical code of conduct based on the BBC's model. In the print media and the internet, the South African Press Council. You go to them. We at News 24 follow the model of the South African Press Council's code of conduct. That is the code that is our sort of Bible or Quran or whatever holy book you want to call it, that guides us how we should respond to complaints. And it helps a lot. Ethics is a grey area. That is the big problem. You can't take a thing out of context and say, this is the absolute rule. There are no absolute rules. Yeah. A rule may apply in one case, and in another case it may not apply, because you must see the whole context of it.
It's that whole thing about minimum harm, maximum truth, and you know that balance, what is the right thing to do under these circumstances, because it can be different under other circumstances. I see Marinette also wants to respond.
I just wanted to remind Kamba that he wrote the code of conduct for their own website this week, so maybe you should think about that.
Okay, Mpumi.
But there's another question, a subtext to his question, which is, you know, you ask it in a form of a code of conduct, but there's another issue of agendas.
Yeah.
I think what he's trying to say is that, you know, different newsrooms have got different posture towards a particular issue. So, and I think we must be very honest, if we want to live in a constitutional stroke liberal democracy, it would mean that we should accept that there will be divergent views. So a particular newspaper might consider itself a left-wing newspaper. Another one might consider itself a right-wing newspaper or mid-center, whatever. But I think that notwithstanding the different ideological dispositions of these different publications, there must be some kind of a minimum agreement. And I think that's where you come in about minimum head, maximum truth. You know, we should not disagree. Well, we can disagree. I must be very careful. George is here. He's a science. I nearly said we shouldn't disagree about what's the truth. But I think sometimes we should disagree about what's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
What we should not disagree about is that we are all pursuing the truth, whatever the truth is.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful quote from Walter Lippmann. He was an American thought leader, philosopher, a public intellectual, if I can use that word. He said, he wrote this in 1943, he said, the theory of the free press is not that the truth will be presented completely or perfectly in any one instance, but that the truth will emerge from free discussion. Mm. Isn't that very true of what we even are supposed to do today?
And I think if we can end on that, I think that is the purpose of media and keeping the channels open and the freedom, the flow of information, the news flow, etc. And I think that is also what we celebrate today. It's really journalism serving the public, serving the interest of the public. And if I think we can continue the discussion outside, because I'd like to invite all of you now. I think you've deserved it. A nice cool Chardonnay or whatever they have outside. We're going to move right next door to the Platan Café, where we're going to toast the department, journalism, everything we can think of. So please, an open invitation, join us next door for a toast on the department. It's not going to be long, and then we continue the discussion. Thank you very much for attending. I'll see you next door. Thank you.